From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, what is the purpose of religion? That question took on new urgency for religion scholar Elaine Pagels when her six-year-old son died. A year later, her husband died in a mountain climbing accident. People said to her, "Your faith must sustain you."
I've never felt further than anything they were calling faith than at a time of intense grief. That felt extremely remote to me. And I did wonder, how can one go through this? How can one survive it? I wasn't certain that I could at all.
She eventually turned to meditation she learned from Trappist monks, and she researched ancient Jewish and Christian texts and the Gnostic Gospels. Her book is Why Religion? A Personal Story. Also, we remember New Age guru Ram Dass, who died last month, and John Powers marks the centennial of the birth of filmmaker Federico Fellini. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University, has made it her job to ask some big, tough questions, such as, why look to ancient texts, beliefs, and practices in an age when scientists have made so many breakthroughs about the nature and origin of the universe? But after two family tragedies, her questions became deeply personal. In 1987, her life was shattered by the death of her son, Mark, at the age of 6.5, following a long illness. Then, just over a year after what she thought was the worst loss she could imagine, her husband, Heinz Pagels, a theoretical physicist and the executive director of the New York Academy of Sciences, died in a mountain climbing accident. Her long period of grieving led to her book, Why Religion? A Personal Story, that combined memoir and biblical scholarship to reflect on how she found faith and lost it, but kept searching. Why Religion comes out in paperback next week. Elaine Pagels eventually found solace and meaning in ancient Jewish and Christian texts and in the meditation methods she was taught by Trappist monks. She's best known for her writings on the Gnostic Gospels, the Christian texts that were omitted from the canon because they were considered heretical. Terry Gross spoke with her in 2018.
Elaine Pagels, welcome to Fresh Air. You write, many of us have left religious institutions behind and prefer to identify as spiritual, not religious. You say, I've done both, had faith and lost it, joined groups and left them. To my own surprise, yes. I went back, wanting to understand what happened and to explore the stories, poetry, music, and art that make up religious traditions. You grew up in a secular family, and you write, religion actually made your father angry. Why?
Yes, it made him angry because he'd been raised by fiercely Presbyterian parents who apparently talked a great deal about hell and damnation, and he wanted to get out of that as soon as he could. So when he heard about Darwin, he just abandoned the whole ship and said, that's for people who aren't educated, not people like us. So he wanted to distance himself from that, became a scientist, and said, this is the way to find truth.
Did you grow up a skeptic about religion?
I didn't grow up a skeptic. The family was culturally Protestant. So sometimes my mother took us to a Methodist church, which seemed to me well-meaning and basically fairly boring, that particular church. And it didn't have an enormous impact.
Well, you were born again at the age of 15 after some friends convinced you, you were living in Palo Alto, and some friends convinced you to go to San Francisco with them to hear Billy Graham as part of his crusade for Christ. What year do you think that was?
That was marvelous. It was at the end of the 50s, I think, when mm-hmm. I was a teenager. I didn't know what I was getting into. I just thought it might be interesting. And I found it enormously powerful. And that was a big surprise. And of course, as you say, it really made my parents horrified when they heard that I'd actually jumped right in.
You joined the other side.
Well, born again, I mean, that was probably their worst nightmare, evangelical Christianity. What I realize is that there's a great deal of power in that kind of conviction that Billy Graham expressed that was articulated through the music. There were 18,000 people in Candlestick Park, which is a sports arena. It was an overpowering experience. And Billy Graham, to my surprise, was talking about the United States in a way that I'd never heard. So that struck me deeply.
What did he say that struck you like that?
Well, first of all, he said that what he preached was going to be sound very strange to intellectuals and academics. And that's the world I grew up in because my father was in that world. And it really did. He, first of all, denounced America for driving its most brilliant sons, of course, then he only thought of men doing this, into the sciences to build bigger nuclear weapons. And this is only decades after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And to hear him talk about America, about nuclear weapons used against the Japanese, about slavery and segregation, I was totally hooked because I'd never heard anyone speak that way, and it sounded accurate.
And were there spiritual things that he said that spoke to you as well?
Yes, he also appealed completely to somebody who just turned 15. He said, now you can have a new life. You can be born again. You can break out of the confines of the world you live in. For me, that was suburban Palo Alto, and sort of break into a new universe, a much larger canvas, and find a new family. And I thought, wow, that was an irresistible invitation.
So, you know, it's interesting that death tested your faith pretty soon. You know, you were looking to art and music and poetry for a sense of larger meaning, too. And
yes,
a good friend of yours named Paul was a painter, and he taught you about painting, and you were very close. And then he was killed in a car crash. He was a passenger
yes.
in the car. And that tested your faith because of things that your fellow Christian friends said to you. What were some of those things?
I went back to my evangelical friends. My friend Paul, who was killed, was 16 in high school. And when I went back to the evangelical church, my friends were very sympathetic, and they said, oh, that's terrible. Was he born again? And I said, no, he was Jewish. And then they looked at me stunned and said, well, then he's in hell. And I thought, what? That has nothing to do with what attracted me to this kind of community, this kind of conviction. God loves you, all of that. It has nothing to do with that. It's antithetical. And I felt completely alone, walked out of there, and never went back.
So yeah. A little detour here, because this is the part of your story that intersects with Jerry Garcia. And I thought, what, Elaine Pagels knew Jerry Garcia before he was in The Grateful Dead? That just kind of shocked me. So was he in that car accident?
Yes. He had been in Palo Alto playing music, hanging out at various places, Ken Kesey's house up in Los Trancos Woods, and in town. And he was older than the rest of us, but those of us in high school who knew that group were fascinated. He was a brilliant guitarist, and he taught us all kinds of music we never heard of. So I didn't know him very closely, but he was very much a part of that group. When Paul, my friend, was killed in a car crash, it was coming from a party where Jerry and Alan Trist, who was later his business manager, were in the car, as well as two other people. And Jerry was actually thrown out of the windshield. And Alan, I think, broke his back, or he had a terrible accident. And so we became, after that, rather close friends, because we spent time together after the accident with a couple of other friends who had known each other before.
You speculate in the book that the Grateful Dead was named in part because he survived this car crash and, you know, Paul did not. Do you have any evidence that that really was the source of the name of the band?
Yes, I did speculate that. It seemed obvious to me. And then later I read something about it. I didn't see him after that. I mean, after he formed the group, that was years later. But I saw in a biography about the group that he said that accident woke him up and made him realize he didn't have endless time and he had to get serious. And so the name of the group, as I understand it, came from that accident.
Okay, let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Elaine Pagels. Her new book is called Why Religion? A Personal Story. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is religion scholar and professor at Princeton University, Elaine Pagels. Her new book is called Why Religion? A Personal Story. So a question that you've always had, and this question kind of resounds throughout your book, is why does religion continue to exist? With all we know about science now, why does religion exist, and what do we want from it? It's not a question that you can answer in the course of an interview, but along those same lines, you know, you're a historian of religion, so whether you practice a specific religion or not, you are immersed in the texts of Judaism, Christianity. Your late husband, Heinz Pagels, was a theoretical physicist and studied chaos theory. Can you talk about some of the similarities and differences between how you approached similar questions about the workings of the world and finding meaning in life? Him from his point of view as a theoretical physicist studying chaos theory, and you from your point of view studying the great religious texts, or at least some of the great religious texts.
The question I started asking after I'd left that church for years, I thought there's something powerful there. That what was it? Was it about Christianity? Was it about religion? What was it? Part of it, Terry, was a kind of emotionally charged, imaginative language that is spoken in these traditions, you know, and was not really spoken in my home. It was also based on the assumption that science was somehow equivalent to religion. Years later, when I met Heinz, he said to me, "Why religion? Why do you do something that has no impact in the real world?" And I said, "Well, why do you do elementary particles?" And we sort of laughed and argued and realized that we were both looking for some fundamental way of understanding our experience. And what I came to see, living with this wonderful scientist and wonderful man, is that he understood that physics does not answer metaphysical questions. And religions are a different kind of paradigm, an imaginative paradigm that talks about meaning in ways that scientists don't and can't. And so these are complementary. I came to understand that. And that's one of the reasons that the religious traditions aren't obsolete.
I want to get back to your personal story. You and your husband had a baby after trying to conceive and then fertility treatment. So you gave birth to a son, but he was born with a serious heart problem that would require surgery after he reached the age of one and was strong enough to endure the surgery. The surgery seemed to go okay, but you later discovered that he had another fatal problem, pulmonary hypertension. You were told that that was fatal, that it would eventually, sooner or later, lead to an early death. Your son died when he was 6 1/2. So for 6 1/2 years, you loved your son knowing that he wouldn't live long. And instead of planning for his future, when you looked into the future, you saw his death. And when he died, you felt guilty, even though it sounds like you did everything to give him the maximum amount of love and care. Why do you think you felt guilty?
That's a good question. Because parents who are given a very difficult diagnosis about a child will do anything. And also, physicians will do anything. They go to extreme lengths to deal with trying to treat a child with that kind of thing. And yet, what I was reading at the time, I felt just in agony, of course, about this, because it matters more to a parent than our own lives, you know, that our children survive. And yet there was nothing we could do. That sense of helplessness was almost intolerable. And I realized that I felt guilty about it. And yet at a certain critical point in my son's treatment, I realized that the guilt was only masking something much deeper and much more painful than guilt. And what it was masking was the fact that we were helpless, that there was nothing we could do. We had no input. As long as I felt guilty, I felt, well, at least it's my fault, or I have some agency in something that matters more to me than my own life. But if I have no agency, I mean, that's almost intolerable. And I realized that I'd rather feel guilty than helpless. It's a choice I made unconsciously, and I think many people do, because the feeling that we can't do anything and we have no input is more than we can bear.
After your son died, some people said to you, your faith must have sustained you. What was your reaction when people said that to you?
When people said that, I thought, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never felt further than anything they were calling faith than at a time of intense grief. That felt extremely remote to me. And I did wonder, you know, how can one go through this? How can one survive it? I wasn't certain that I could at all.
In the story of Jesus, You know, the story is that God sacrificed the life of his son. So you put that in your words.
Well, I remember after our son died, I went to the Church of the Heavenly Rest in New York to talk to people there about the service that we would have. And I heard somebody preparing for Easter, it was right before Easter, talking about God so loved the world that he gave his only son to save the world from sin or something. And I just thought, any God who did that would have to be crazy. I mean, that doesn't make sense. Our only son had just died. How could one do that for any reason? Now, I understand why it's said historically. I understand how it was put together that way. But it struck me as dissonant that this was somehow a sacrifice and something that would have been willed. What I found later in one of the secret texts from the discoveries in Upper Egypt with the Gospel of Thomas was a text called the Gospel of Truth. And that one has a very different perspective. It doesn't see suffering as sort of ennobling, as teaching you something, as deepening your faith. I don't like to say good things about suffering. I don't like suffering. It's very painful. But this other text talks about suffering not as if it were some kind of wonderful state that can teach you a spiritual lesson. I think that kind of piety is very much overrated. Certainly it would have been for me. But rather this spoke about the fact that when people suffer, there is a potential in that dreadful complex of experiences of grief to open up to other people in a deeper way, that it can demonstrate our connection with all other people. And for me, that feels accurate, and I'm grateful for that.
On the first anniversary of your husband's death, you went to Colorado, where he was killed in the mountain climbing accident and where you used to summer, and you meditated with the Trappist monks who you'd befriended there. And you say you used to have a tape loop in your mind of your husband falling from the cliff toward the rocks below.
Yes.
And that's where the tape would stop and then start over again. So you had this constant image of him falling toward the rocks, but that's as far as the image went. But
yes.
When you were meditating with the Trappist monks, that image in your mind continued, and you actually saw in your mind your husband hitting the rocks. What do you think it was about meditating with the monks that furthered that image? And what was it like to live with that image as opposed to having it ending before the moment of impact?
That's a good question. That tape loop began as soon as I heard of the accident. It seemed to flip through my imagination every few seconds, and then every 5 seconds, and maybe 10 or 20. By a year later, it was less frequent, but it was often there. When I went into the chapel with Theophane, whose name means God manifest, an extraordinary monk, and we meditated for about an hour, there's a great deal of sense of support in the silence of that communal meditation. And I felt that I dared. This was not a conscious choice. I felt that I allowed that image to go where it was going, to actually envision the whole accident. It felt to me as though I actually saw it happen. Although, as I said later to a counselor that one of my friends referred me to, a grief counselor, she said, well, people don't really think someone has died. They don't really believe somebody has died until they can actually envision the whole event. And when someone dies, say, in an airplane accident, it's very hard to do that. So somehow, I think we need to be able to imagine and experience as much as possible of what happened, because it's a constant preoccupation for people in grief. And when that happened, it was shocking. It was also some kind of release, because That's what happened. I said to the grief counselor, well, everything about it seemed completely realistic, except there was so much blood, that couldn't have been realistic. And she looked at me and said, that's what happens in this kind of accident.
So once you had that kind of image completed with the moment of impact and the blood, did the tape loop stop?
That's an interesting question, Terry. I hadn't thought of it. It certainly was never as obsessive as it was before. I don't go through that tape loop now.
Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University, speaking to Terry Gross in 2018. Her book, Why Religion? A Personal Story, comes out next week in paperback. After a break, we'll continue their conversation. Also, we remember Ram Dass, the American spiritual teacher who died last month at age 88. And our critic at large, John Powers, looks at the work of Italian filmmaker Federico Fellini, who was born 100 years ago this month. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2018 interview with Elaine Pagels. She's a professor of religion at Princeton and author of the book Why Religion? A Personal Story, which comes out in paperback next week. It's about the death of her 6-year-old son, which was followed a year later by the death of her husband, and about how she turned to the ancient texts she studies and to the meditation she learned from Trappist monks to help survive her grief. One of her previous books was a bestseller devoted to the Gnostic Gospels.
You're right. We blame ourselves when we're suffering. Suffering feels like punishment, like we're being punished for something. Did you go through that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was reading anthropologists, too. That quote that suffering feels like punishment comes from an anthropologist. And then another who wrote about the accidental death of his young wife when they were working together in the Philippines. She also fell from a cliff and was killed. He talks about guilt, and he says, Western people raised in Jewish and Christian tradition in which, say, the story of Genesis says that we only die because Adam sinned. In other words, humans are guilty. If we weren't guilty, we wouldn't die. Now, that's, I think, scientifically ridiculous. But psychologically, it's rather powerful. And he said there's another response that this masks, which is also anger. And he talked about that. So the turmoil of feelings is very complicated, as anyone in that situation knows. And we had to struggle with it, try to untangle it, try to cope with it, and then at some way let it go.
So you've spoken of meditation, of prayer. Where are you now in terms of your religious life?
I love my work because it allows me to explore the religious life of countless people in countless ages in different traditions. I find that there are important elements of my experience that resonate with what I hear in Jewish and Christian and Buddhist tradition. I think of it as Marianne Moore says of poetry. She talks about poetry as imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And I think, well, the gardens may be imaginary, like the Garden of Eden, but there are human realities in the story that I connect with, just the way that, you know, you and I would connect with the real truth, say, in a poem, in a writing of fiction, in music, and it touches us deeply, even though the poem and the fiction may not be literally true. When you're dealing with matters of this kind of experience, they can't be articulated in some direct way. You know, as Emily Dickinson said, you tell the truth, but tell it slant. You know, you have to put it into metaphor or into silence or into some kind of image or story.
So you find the stories powerful and meaningful, but you don't believe in God per se. Is that a good description?
People ask about believing in God. You know, Terry, I think that belief is overrated. Talking about religions as if they were about belief takes an image that's basically forged in Christian tradition and applies it to Judaism, applies it to Buddhism or Hinduism. And in other traditions, belief is not so much the center as practice. Saying the prayers, saying the Shema, or going to worship, participating with others in certain acts, prayer. Those things, I think, are more meaningful to me than sets of beliefs. I react the way I do because Christianity in particular was formulated in the 4th century as a set of doctrines in the Nicene Creed, as you know. And, you know, that's all very nice for the 4th century. But I don't find that a compelling statement for me. So I don't think it feels like so much a matter of what you believe, but how you engage these traditions, how you live into them and share them with other people. But that's why, for me, it is not simply one tradition that speaks to it.
So when you describe your version of religion as a practice, are there rituals or ceremonies or prayers from whatever religion that is a part of your practice? Or do you see, like, scholarship as being the practice? Like, understanding and making connections as being the practice?
I do it all. Mm-hmm. I love scholarship and research. It's a wonderful part of my life. I go to an Episcopal church often. I love the music. The person who's the priest there is a man of spiritual depth, which I deeply appreciate. I go to yoga almost every day. That's a physical and also contemplative practice. Meditate sometimes, walk in the woods, see my friends. I would say all of it. I don't mean to mean that this is, it's all part of a whole mosaic of different parts of one's life. But I do have a sense that seeking for what I would call a spiritual dimension and engaging it is something that is very important to my life. That's why I said, when people say, are you religious? I say, yes, incorrigibly. That doesn't mean that I, you know, go to church every day. It means that, I'm enormously susceptible to what you spoke of before, the music, the rituals, the traditions, the prayers that I find there, and also to those that we create. I wrote about also creating rituals, and many people do that. Many artists do that. And what many artists do is feels to me very closely akin to what I'm talking about.
You end your book with a Jewish prayer. Blessed art thou, Lord God of the universe, that you have brought us alive to see this day. What does that mean to you?
As I wrote, it's very surprising to me that long after these events happened, I feel alive and well. The children that I had to raise are alive and well. That people can recover from things that seemed impossible to recover from. I did see other people go into despair, and that for me seemed like a real possibility. I didn't want to go there. I wanted to find an alternative to that, to find a way to live with hope and joy and courage. And that prayer speaks to coming out of that kind of isolation and fear. It speaks about gratitude for how we get through things.
Well, Elaine Pagels, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reflecting so much about your life, your grief, the role of religion in your life as a scholar and just as a person. And thank you for writing your book.
Well, thank you. I've really loved talking with you about it.
Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University, spoke to Terry Gross in 2018. Her book, Why Religion, A Personal Story, comes out next week in paperback. Coming up, we remember Ram Dass, the American spiritual teacher who died last month at age 88. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years. DanaFarber.org/everywhere. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wild lands. Learn more at awf.org.
This is Fresh Air. In the early 1960s, Richard Alpert was a Harvard professor of psychology, conducting clinical research into the use of psychedelics. But then, he and his colleague Timothy Leary were fired from Harvard in 1963. After continuing his experiments off campus, Alpert went to India in 1967, where he met his guru and studied yoga and meditation. His spiritual teacher gave him a new name, Ram Dass. And when Ram Dass returned to the States, he was perceived as something of a guru himself. His 1971 book of advice, Be Here Now, became a bestseller. When Richard Alpert became Ram Dass, his father mocked the change, and there was an enormous rift between the hippie hero son and the father who had served as president of the New York New Haven Railroad. But in the last years of his father's life, Ram Dass lived with his father and cared for him. Ram Dass died last month at age 88. Here's an excerpt of his interview with Terry from 1990.
Can we go back a bunch of years?
Like
Let's go back to the early 60s when you were Richard Alpert and you were a professor of psychology at Harvard University and were one of the first people, and one of the very first East Coast people, to start experimenting with LSD. Mm-hmm. What use were you putting it to in your official capacity in the university?
Well, I'm a research psychologist, and that's a study of the mind, psyche logos. And these chemicals are incredible in overriding habitual ways of seeing the universe and allowing a fresh way of perceiving. And they connected me to levels of my awareness that my Western psychological framework didn't cover. And so just as a student of the mind, I started out with that exploration. In the process of my early experience, I had what later I could acknowledge as spiritual experiences, which for a Western social scientist, spiritual stuff was seen as, like an anthropologist would see or a Freudian would see it, as sublimated something or other, or, you know, the creation of the human mind. But I really tuned into a larger context in which I exist other than my material, sensual thinking context.
So you started using LSD as part of your academic research, but yeah. Once you started actually taking LSD yourself, that academic research no longer seemed relevant?
Well, I'll tell you, it was because we did studies to show, and I think that it's painful to me that in our zeal to say no to drugs, we have not differentiated between the tryptamines, for example, the psychedelics, which have potential for social change, for use. Like, we worked with prisoners in prisons where the recidivism rate is so bad. Working in marriages, working with dying people to help them extricate themselves from identification with being that which dies. There were tremendous potential uses, all of which have been, the research has been wiped out by the society's fear of drugs other than for liquor and, you know, things like that. But so our research continued to... We started in a naturalistic way because those kind of chemicals were seen in our society as psychotomimetics. That is, they were used by psychiatrists to parallel schizophrenia. And while in other cultures they were used for religious and oracular processes, and we said instead of laying a trip on them, let's just give them to people and get reports back and let's see how they use them and build a new kind of context for them. And then we began to see how set and setting were so important, that a person could have them and have a religious experience. They could use them to escape. They could use them for creative work. They could use them for therapeutic change.
You and Timothy Leary at Harvard started using LSD, and then Ken Kesey on the West Coast started using it, I think in very different ways, in a different setting. Did you have any conflicts with Kesey about what LSD should mean in the society, how it should be used?
Well, we were somewhere in the middle because we had Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts and all these people. There was a community of us that mm-hmm. were researching. And in a way, we were saying, let's keep it reasonably quiet so we can research because it's very controversial and it's going to upset the culture. At the same moment, we were opening the door at Harvard with students and so on. So we were partly responsible. Ken blew it apart in a way with the acid tests because he made it a street scene. And that frightened the society so much, it forced the laws, it forced legislation probably a couple of years before it would have happened. And maybe the research could have gotten more entrenched had there been a little more space.
Well, eventually you went to India, studied with a teacher who became your spiritual teacher. Can you tell us something about him and about the kind of spiritual path you took with him?
Well, meeting him was the power of that initially was that everything that I took LSD to touch in my being, I realized he was. In fact, he actually took 900 micrograms of LSD and nothing happened to him because it's like if you're in Detroit, you don't have to take a bus to Detroit. I mean, he was that quality. He had integrated it. So it showed me the potential that a human being, he showed me what a human being could be in terms of freedom from a fixed model of himself and a quality of love that was I experienced as unconditional because he was resting in a place in himself where he didn't want anything from me. He didn't want my money. He didn't want anything. He didn't want my love. He didn't want anything from me. He didn't even want me to change. He didn't want anything. And I had never been in the presence of somebody who didn't want something from me. I mean, that was a big thing for me. That opened my heart a great deal. And he died in 1973, and I would say he is the most real, I don't know how to say it, entity in my consciousness still, now. That once you have a friend like that who has that quality of compassion and has that quality of emptiness and that quality of the giggle, the cosmic giggle, you just carry that with you, and that's the way in which he continues to influence my life.
I want to ask you a question about your father, who we were talking about earlier. He died in the past year. You had been living with him when you weren't on the road and helping to take care of him. He, I don't know how he was when he died, but at one point in his life, he was a wealthy man. Was there an inheritance, and how did you decide to use it?
My guru said to me early on, he said, your father has money? I said, yes. He said, are you going to leave it to you? I said, well, he's going to leave me a portion of it. He said, you're not to accept your inheritance. I said, boy, that's interesting. I mean, to tell that to a Jewish boy is something, you know. I couldn't tell my father because he had raised it, you know, earned it for his kids. And he trusted me so much, he made me the executor and all of that. But what I've done is I divided what went to my brothers and my nieces and nephews, and then the rest of it I've given away.
So you never told him that you weren't going to personally accept it?
No, I felt that that would be hurting him.
So you thought it was okay to not tell him the complete truth about this?
He never asked me.
Okay.
He just assumed. But there was some subtle thing that happened between us, because the minute my guru said that, that money no longer was mine. And in some deep psychological way, that changed my relationship to my father. After that, I wanted him to spend his money. I wanted him to, you know, there was no longer my money that he was using. And I helped him get married. I gave away the bride in his second marriage. I was close friends with him. I helped them enjoy themselves as much as I could. And he sensed that. He sensed that I didn't want something from him. And I think that's why he trusted me to give me power of attorney, to make me executor, you know, as I'm not a lawyer. And so...
Not wanting something from you. That's what you said you felt towards your teacher, that he didn't want anything from
exactly.
you. That's very important to you.
It's quite an art, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite an art.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure, Terry.
Ram Dass speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. The spiritual teacher died last month at age 88. Coming up, critic-at-large John Powers reflects on Italian filmmaker Federico Fellini as we approach the 100th anniversary of his birth. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. This year marks the centennial of the birth of Italian film director Federico Fellini, who was born on January 20, 1920. To celebrate the occasion, the Italian government has packaged a worldwide traveling retrospective of his films, Federico Fellini at 100. Its first stop in the U.S. began yesterday at the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley. Our critic at large, John Powers, has been watching Fellini films of late and says there never was a filmmaker quite like him.
The first foreign filmmaker I ever heard of was Federico Fellini. Back then, he was an international brand name, and aside from Hitchcock, probably the most famous director in the world. La Strada, La Dolce Vita, 8 1/2, Roma, Amarcord. These weren't merely films that all serious filmgoers raced off to see. Their panache inspired generations of directors, from Martin Scorsese and Wong Kar-wai to Woody Allen and Guillermo del Toro. Lavishly Italianate in his earthiness, Fellini was cinema's great laureate of the id. But over the years, his reputation has dipped badly, especially among critics. His maximalist showmanship, nobody ever left a Fellini film grumbling about the small portions, has fallen out of fashion. His reputation now suffers from what the historian E.P. Thompson once termed the enormous condescension of posterity. He's often treated as one of those artists that a less enlightened age than our own used to think a genius. Born 100 years ago in the coastal city of Rimini, Fellini was a child of the provinces, whose early films were anchored to the real world he knew. Indeed, he drew on his own life for his first and often emulated masterpiece, 1953's I Vitelloni, which means something like The Lazy Calves. It's my favorite of his films, a smart, funny, sneakily touching portrait of five young men idling away their lives in a coastal town. Fellini was hungrier than them. He wanted to make it. And 7 years later, his life changed forever with La Dolce Vita. A worldwide sensation about modern decadence, in which a journalist, played by Fellini's alter ego star Marcello Mastroianni, splashes around in the Trevi Fountain with sexy Anita Ekberg, before getting all alienated and bummed. At once glamorous and preachy, the film, which is still powerful, perfectly caught a 1960s zeitgeist, torn between the embrace of booming post-war materialism and a sense of its hollowness. Its success seemed to throw Fellini. His next film, 8½, again stars Mastroianni, this time as Guido Anselmi, a Fellini-like filmmaker who can't think of a subject for his next film and spends his time juggling writers, producers, mistresses, his wife, and his personal fantasies. Beloved by other directors, who keep copying it, most recently by Pedro Almodovar's Pain and Glory, 8½'s gorgeous black-and-white images explode with the brio of a man who portrays his inner life as a circus. Routinely ranked as one of the 10 greatest films of all time, 8½ marked his peak. It transformed Fellini into the very embodiment of the movie director. Countless filmmakers wanted to be him. Yet just like Guido, Fellini's success had cut him off from his roots in history and the everyday world. He had no ideas, and so his theme became himself and his own creativity. From then on, his films were ultimately about the imaginative genius of Fellini, whose name became a marketing tool, as in Fellini's Satyricon and Fellini's Casanova, both of them pretty bad. At his best, he created visually dazzling set pieces, as in the wonderful memory film Amarcord, with its breathtaking visions of a peacock in the snow and an ocean liner emerging in the night. And in Roma, with its unforgettable drive through Roman traffic in a downpour and its hilariously blasphemous Vatican fashion show, complete with priests on roller skates. You'd walk from the theater humming the music by Nino Rota. Yet when the maestro's inspiration flagged, his work increasingly fell into Fellini-esque self-parody, a bombastic world of clowns, big-breasted prostitutes, flatulent schoolchildren, and benignly retrograde sexual politics that looked worse with each passing year. Still, to belabor such faults, especially in a centenary year, is to miss why people love him. I once criticized Fellini to a young director whose film had just won at Cannes, and he glared at me. "You critics and your good taste," he snarled. "You want everything to be well-made and reasonable, and you'd rather die than see anything vulgar. Fellini's too big for your little worries." Though I still have objection to many of the films, I understood what he was saying. For Fellini was more than a director. He was a force. He liked people and had a Roman acceptance of their failings. He understood the power of the body and didn't fear its unruliness. And, at a time when the world felt ever more organized and rationalized, his teeming imagination drew on and celebrated the power of dreams. For all his faults, and maybe because of them, Fellini's best work achieves something most filmmakers never come close to. It captures the boisterous and beautiful messiness of life.
John Powers is critic at large for Fresh Air. On Monday's show, for Martin Luther King Day, Brian Stevenson, one of the leaders in the fight against racial injustice within the justice system. The new film Just Mercy is based on his memoir. Now, Stevenson is trying to get people to confront the racist aspects of America's history, which help explain where we are today. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One NA. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. Learn more at edutopia.org.